I think April 20th, people are going to be looking for something to watch. I made the mistake of going online and looking this up. All the lists out there on all the sites are so unimaginative. There are a whole bunch of Seth Rogen comedies.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if you're trying to, like, expand beyond that, you'll get certain set psychedelic sci-fi, which is usually 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Uh-huh.
Or sometimes the Wizard of Oz perennially makes this yep. list, and maybe more recently Inception. But I finally gave up and I'm like, I'm just turning on my TV. I'm going to go to Max and watch whatever's the first thing in my queue. And I hit the jackpot. This was a movie I did not see when it came out. Speed Racer.
Nice.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I am recommending Speed Racer.
Okay. Noted.
I normally watch movies for their story and stuff like that, but that is not the point here. Like, I didn't even get through it twice. Welcome back to Geek Channel 8. I'm Eric.
And I'm Johanna.
And in just a minute, we will have Rosie joining us by phone. This week, the third Dracula film from 1979, also the highest grossing Dracula film from 1979, which made more money than both Nosferatu and the Frank Langella Dracula combined. Love at First Bite, a vampire comedy. We're going to be talking about that. And a little bit later on the show, we're also going to be talking about the 1995 Wes Craven film Vampire in Brooklyn, an Eddie Murphy vehicle, another vampire comedy. Why are we talking about Vampire in Brooklyn, which is not Dracula, on a Dracula podcast? We'll get to that. We will get to that. But first, Love at First Bite.
There is a creature of the night whose very name strikes terror in the hearts of man. He fears only mirrors, the scent of garlic, and the sight of a crucifix. He feeds upon human blood. Only sunlight or a stake driven through his heart can destroy him or those whose blood he drinks. His name is Dracula.
I love you, and I can give you eternal life.
I knew it, an insurance salesman. I've already got Prudential.
Hello.
Oh, oh, it was wild.
How many times did he bite you?
Oh, that. Just once. I told you it was our first date.
I won't let him get her.
I'll open my light.
Well, Count, what do you say to that?
I would say leave Cindy alone and find yourself a nice Jewish girl, Doctor.
That's the other one, isn't it?
Dracula in New York. His style is irresistible. His curiosity is irrepressible. And when he takes a bite out of the Big Apple, his appetite is insatiable.
If you're hungry, Master, we could ring for the night maid.
When you is gone, nobody's gonna bring you back here once you is dead.
Good evening.
Please be careful.
What is it?
You nearly stepped on my dinner.
Bon appetit.
I heard a rooster crow.
A rooster? In New York City?
I cannot believe what I'm hearing.
It's him!
Yeah, or a rock group.
The second way to kill a vampire, Count. Three silver bullets through the heart.
No, Rosenberg. That is a fair wolf.
Really? Are you sure? I've lost her forever. He's drained all the blood out of her.
George Hamilton.
His blood in your eyes.
Susan St. James, Richard Benjamin, Dick Shawn, Sherman Hemsley, Isabel Sanford, and Artie Johnson as Renfield.
Finally, after 712 years, to have someone bite me again.
Love at first bite.
We've had a lot of shows that came from the year 1979, so I figured I would focus on popular television and music. A lot of the popular TV shows during that time were All My Children, The Love Boat, Three's Company, Dallas, Different Strokes, Taxi, and my personal favorite, Morgan Mindy. Some popular musicians and songs, the Bee Gees were huge. Donna Summer had Hot Stuff and Bad Girls. There was also Michael Jackson's, his album Off the Wall came out that year. Disco was still rolling pretty hard during that period of time. Also, some popular films, we had Superman the Movie, Every Which Way But Loose, The Muppet Movie, The Deer Hunter, and Kramer versus Kramer, which actually won a lot of Academy Awards that year.
I'm sure there's a lot to go into about the production of the film, but to be honest, I'm going to use the entirety of my time just to talk about the film star George Hamilton.
Awesome.
Who should have so many biographies, like, you know, television shows about this guy. What a weirdo, and what a backstory.
We last saw him as Hagen's replacement, as the Corleone family lawyer.
Yes, in Godfather 3.
Godfather Part 3. That was the last time we talked about him on the show, but we didn't really talk too much about who George Hamilton is, so go ahead and tell us.
Yes, well, Godfather Part 3, I think, is maybe the highlight of his career. You may know George Hamilton from other wonderful films such as Light in the Piazza, but also Doctor, You've Got to Be Kidding, and Elvis, That's the Way It Is, The Man Who Loved Cat Dancing, Evel Knievel the Movie, Zorro, The Gay Blade, Love at First Bite, which we will talk about anon, Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, Double Dragon, Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles, which I think I actually have seen.
Oh, I've seen at least half the movies you've mentioned already.
What? You've seen Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag?
Yeah. Eight Heads in the Duffel Bag was part of that whole series of everybody ripping off Quentin Tarantino. It was that kind of a movie.
Right. Okay. And then perhaps my favorite title, All the Fine Young Cannibals, which I think actually is a good film from what I've heard. And I'd say half of his credits, he is playing himself, uncredited, as a cameo. Because the man is a legend. He's a legend partially due to his magnificent tan. And in fact, some of his business endeavors included launching the George Hamilton skincare system and the George Hamilton sun care system and tanning salons.
I suspect that's why he was cast in this, and then, like, the makeup artist didn't get the message, so they made him pale. I'm like, I think that was supposed to be the gag here. But anyway, go ahead.
Too late. He also had a cigar lounge bearing his name in New York and Las Vegas, and there was an article in Cigar Aficionado that described Hamilton's style as Cary Grant meets Pat Riley, which is spot on. He was the Grand Marshal for the 79th Annual Shenandoah Apple Blossom Festival in Winchester, Virginia. And in 2016 and 2018, Hamilton appeared as the Crispy Colonel in commercials for KFC. So the tannest version of Colonel Sanders.
Wow.
But then it gets even more interesting from there. Apparently, you know, I mean, the man is fairly good looking, despite being clearly a weirdo. He dated Linda Bird Johnson, daughter of U.S. President Lyndon Johnson, in 1966. And he also had an affair with Imelda Marcos, the wife of the dictator. So in the Philippines, he had business ties to the Marcos family, and he was named but not indicted as a co-conspirator in a federal fraud and racketeering case. He was friends with Burt Reynolds, which you can totally picture.
You can see that, can't you?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. you know, I started this by saying there should be a movie made about this guy. There kind of was. So if you want to check out the film My One and Only, a 2009 comedy starring Logan Lerman, it is apparently loosely based on George Hamilton's early life and rocky relationship with his mother and brother. I think that's enough about George Hamilton. Can't wait to dig into his performance in Love at First Bite.
I got us some champagne and a little Maui Wowie, really heavy shit.
I do not drink wine.
Oh.
And I do not smoke shit.
I generally don't think of the 1970s as being a big wine decade. To me, it is the height of cocktails. Mm-hmm. It's all about the cocktails. There are a bunch of cocktails that were popular at the time, but the one that I think fits this movie, and I actually had when I was watching this film, a Bloody Mary.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
We've done Bloody Marys on the show before, or we had it once before, I think, as our pick. So the recipe is not going to be very detailed, but I am instead going to get into, got curious about the history of the Bloody Mary. And so there are numerous theories about the origins of the Bloody Mary, but here's just one of them. There was a bartender, or probably still is, as far as I know, Fernand Petiot. He's a French bartender who was alleged to have invented it in 1921 at Harry's New York Bar in Paris. Harry's was popular with expat writers like Gertrude Stein, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, that crowd in the between the war period, right? Later, with celebrities like Humphrey Bogart, Coco Chanel, Rita Hayworth. It's also the bar James Bond called the best place in Paris to get a solid drink in Casino Royale. In a 2011 interview with the BBC, then manager of Harry's New York bar, Elaine Da Silva said, quote, "The story is that there were a few customers, a few friends, and the bartender Petiot made a cocktail for them with tomato juice and vodka. It got its name because one of the friends said, 'It looks like my girlfriend who I met in a cabaret.' The cabaret's name was The Bucket of Blood, and the name of the lady was Mary. So it was very simple to call it a Bloody Mary," unquote. Sorry, that was all a quote. But Fernand Petiot himself claimed to have invented the modern Bloody Mary in 1934 at the King Cole Room in New York. This is actually in New York City, New York's St. Regis Hotel. In his book, Words of Mercury, legendary British travel writer Patrick Lee Fermor, who, like George Hamilton, is himself a very interesting character. He lived for years in a castle in Romania as the lover of the Romanian princess, was possible real-life inspiration for both James Bond and Indiana Jones, part of the resistance against the Nazis on the island of Crete. Anyway, he's a well-known British travel writer. He proposed another theory that the name came from an English mispronunciation of the Slav syllables of a drink called a Vladimir. Supposedly, the customer at the New York bar for whom Petiot first prepared the drink in 1921 was Vladimir Smirnov. Yes, that Smirnov, as in the vodka family. So there's some credence to this here. It's also appropriate because we have a character named Vladimir in this. I'm pretty sure we did a Bloody Mary episode before on this show, so you can look for that in the archives to get a good Bloody Mary recipe from scratch. But I didn't really want to mess around with all those ingredients this time. I just wanted to jump into the movie. So I just went with a Bloody Mary mix that you can buy at your supermarket. 1 ounce of vodka, 5 ounces of Bloody Mary mix, shaken with ice, served on the rocks. That's what I had while watching this movie.
I actually drank wine with this film. I drank a red wine called Naughty Red from Chateau Chantal in Traverse City, Michigan. And when I got this bottle of wine, I got, you know, like a case of wine. And when I got it in 2022, I was not impressed, but I've let them sit in my basement now for the last 2 years, and they are perfect and very naughty. So recommend.
All right. Well, let's jump into talking about Love at First Bite, which I think might have originally been titled Dracula Sucks before they settled on Love at First
Bite. I heard it was Dracula Sucks Again.
Okay. Well, it begins with a lot of dry ice and a coffin opening up, and out comes George Hamilton as Dracula to the sounds of many, many, many wolves howling. And we open with Children of the Night. Shut up.
This is actually my favorite version of that line that we've had so far.
So we're going to jump into this pretty fast. Romanian gymnast training camp wants to take over, which, remember, it's the Cold War and the Communist Party's in charge. This actually kind of works that, like, someone from the Romanian royal family or whatever being, like, ousted from their castle.
I love the line that he gives as he's departing, like, where all the townspeople know he's a vampire and they're, you know, like, eager to be rid of him. And he's more or less not resisting. And he says, yeah, fine, I'll leave. But, you know, just think about how interesting this place will be without me. It'll be like Bucharest on a Monday night.
Yeah. I wrote that line down in my notes.
Basically, he's going to go to New York in search of this woman. This starts to become a theme in Dracula movies starting now. We're going to see it in another one we're talking about today, where there's like some prophesized woman. It's not just like he sees Mina on a locket and is like, I'm going to go
get that dame. Yeah,
I'm going to go hit that.
I'm going to go tap that. Is that what you were going for?
Yeah. but instead, there's this one woman who I think Renfield, his Renfield here, has found is in New York City. So that's where they're going.
I liked the parts in Romania. I was like, okay, you know, this is going to be like a corny, stupid film, but like there will be parts that will be enjoyable. And then as soon as we land in New York, it just goes in a different direction. And it is one of the most offensive films that I've seen in a while. Like, the comedy does not hold up. And it's sort of one of those things where, like, if I were putting a warning in front of this, I would say something like, this was not funny back then, and it is still not funny now.
It has aged poorly. It does not hold up. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to find. Nobody really wants to re-release this. You can't find it anywhere. You know, we had a really hard time digging it up for the show.
Yeah. And I'm bringing it up now because the depiction of Black Harlem, which, you know, it's a funny idea. It's a funny idea to put, you know, Count Dracula in Black Harlem, but it's not funny the way they did it. So, really, really offensive towards Black people in a way that seemed unnecessary and unfortunate.
Yeah, they threw in every possible stereotype they could on that one, you know, which it was common for a lot of comedies back then to do that, unfortunately. But yeah, taking it a different direction, though, I loved that they used Art Johnson as Renfield, who was also on Fantasy Island. He was like one of those kind of annoying sketch comedians that just would pop up in random places. And I thought he was a good fit for that role in this film.
I agree. I thought he was one of the stronger Renfields, actually.
Yeah. And can we talk about the scene where they're driving in the Volkswagen Beetle and they have the coffin sticking out the back?
That was great.
A lot of people did not like the film, even at the time. Gene Siskel, who of the Siskel and Ebert team, I always liked his reviews better. He gave it 0 stars.
Rightfully so.
But it also did fairly well. Like we said, it like more than doubled what the serious Frank Langella Dracula made at the box office.
Yeah, well, it had, and also it had a $3 million budget, but somehow made almost $44 million worldwide. Yikes.
Yeah. What kind of surprised me is if you look at this one compared to, say, Dracula Dead and Loving It, the Mel Brooks film, that one holds up better. Still not very funny, but holds up better, but is liked far less in general. Was disliked more than this one. Like, for instance, Love at First Bite has a 70% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, which is way higher than I would expect.
See, this is why you cannot trust the Tomatometer. The Tomatometer is garbage.
Or you could look at its ranking on, say, IMDb, which is with users, and it's way higher than Dracula Dead and Loving It. But anyway, we won't get too far off track with that. There's this woman, played by Susan St. James. What is her character name?
Cindy Sondheim.
Cindy.
Yeah.
And Cindy is a model in New York City, and that's who Dracula believes is this reincarnation of this woman that he's destined to be with. She has a psychiatrist slash boyfriend, Jeffrey Rosenberg, who is a Van Helsing. He's like Van Helsing's grandson or something like that. He's played by Richard Benjamin. Richard Benjamin visited my house one time.
What?
Yeah, so I had gone to college, and this production company, it's just a van of like 4 or 5 people, came to scout my parents' house for this movie that was being directed by Richard Benjamin, and it was called Milk Money. I happened to come home that weekend or whatever and met him. Richard Benjamin was one of the people there. They loved my room, but they decided that the house was too modern for what they were looking for. But he flipped when he walked in my room, and I had like my dresser had stickers all over it. And one prominent sticker right in the front was Malcolm McDowell from A Clockwork Orange. You know, that holding the knife and everything. Yeah. And he flipped for that. And they took photos of that. And I'm like, what's up? And they're like, he's probably going to be in this film.
Aw.
So, yeah, we got to chat with him. Mostly my dad chatted with him about a movie called Last of Sheila. But I never saw that, so I don't know anything about it. Anyway, back to this.
I actually thought he was pretty good in this, playing this, you know, again, like another stereotype, you know, playing the neurotic Jewish doctor, but actually very funny. Like he was one of the consistently funnier actors in this film.
Yep. Who got brought extra crispy chicken when he was in.
Yes.
So there's this dance scene where Dracula is trying to romance Cindy. And I got to the end of this movie and I saw in the credits there was I Love the Nightlife.
Mm. Yeah.
Big disco hit. And I was like, what a perfect song. You know, that would be perfect, especially for the dance scene. Why didn't they use that? I don't remember that song being in this movie at all. And I scrolled back and sure enough, that's not what they're dancing to. And nowhere in the film could I find that song. And then afterward on the video was the trailer for this, which had that in it during the scene where they're dancing. And sure enough, did a little research and found out that that was the original song they were dancing to in this. Due to rights issues, it was pulled for all home video releases.
Oh no!
This really pretty much pissed off fans of the movie because it's like the best scene, right? And that song, I Love the Nightlife, is just like perfect for a Dracula film, right? If you're going to pick a disco song, that's it!
Right, exactly.
As a recovering punk rocker, I'm obligated to hate disco, but if you're going to go that direction, if you're going to have disco Dracula, that's the disco song to do, you know? I think a lot of things in this film also were probably funny originally, but they've been so done to death since then that they're cliche. Like, I seem to remember even hearing this at the time, that the idea of raiding the blood bank was considered kind of innovative. Nobody had done that. That was comedy gold, you know? But nowadays, that's happened in so many vampire films since. You know, that's just like almost a staple of the genre now.
Right.
Any modern vampire film, you know?
I've seen the robbing the blood bank thing show up in serious vampire films where they're like vampires who are trying to be good. But the use of it here, I thought, worked really well because they were clearly trying to make Dracula much less menacing in this movie. He's like your friendly neighborhood vampire. The villagers hate him, but, you know, he's not really terrifying. And so trying to find a solution to the, like, how can we be rooting for this sad romantic who's in love with the supermodel if he's also, you know, a blood-sucking murderer? Like, no, it's not going to work. So they had to find a way to kind of make him safe for public consumption.
George Hamilton as a vampire, the villagers hate me, but the ladies love to date me. Hey. When Art Johnson, who played Renfield, walked into the modeling office to meet Cindy Sondheim and basically kidnap her and give her to Dracula, when he walked in, one of the secretaries there in the front office was like, "Didn't I see him on Fantasy Island?" Which is funny because he actually wasn't a character on Fantasy Island, too. And then another thing, too, George and Wheezy Jefferson were both in that movie. The actor who played George Jefferson was the pastor for the funeral scene.
Yeah.
And then Wheezy later played the judge when they ended up in court. So I just thought that was cool that they both had roles in there.
Yeah. And that is super progressive, actually. A black woman judge in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it'd be progressive now.
Which makes me think that the movie's heart was in the right place. It just was so wrong, you know?
And there was another progressive line in there, too, in early in the film when they first kind of introduced Cindy Sondheim's character, where she's having a conversation with somebody, and she said, you know, one of these days, homosexuality is just going to be the norm.
Yeah, I caught that. Yeah.
Welcome to 2024. It's one of these days it's going to be just as normalized as heterosexuality and people won't even care who you love. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. But we're getting there. It's a lot more socially acceptable. You see gay families on TV now. Hey, love it.
For all the film's missteps and reprehensible casual racism, one of the things that I think works for the film is that it really doesn't take itself very seriously, and that there are a lot of lines like the ones that Rosie mentioned that are, you know, breaking the fourth wall. And, you know, the conclusion of the film of, you know, that the doctor feels okay about Cindy going off. She pays her bill and he says, yeah, she's become a responsible person or whatever. And just like, there are some lines like that where it's like, okay, you know, at least this film isn't trying to be anything other than what it is. So I have to give it props for that.
For centuries, they have roamed the earth. Fearsome creatures of the night. Endlessly seeking to satisfy an unyielding hunger. Now, the world's last vampire is about to encounter something infinitely more terrifying than himself. Brooklyn.
Interesting. I've been stabbed, and I've been hanged. Even broken on the rack once, but I've never been shot before. It kind of itches a little.
Paramount Pictures presents...
No! If you're hungry, I'll run you down to KFC down the street and hit you off with a two-piece.
I already had Italian.
Eddie Murphy.
Do I look like I would bite you?
Angela Bassett.
You bet not. Not after the day I've had.
Eddie Murphy.
Everything! Come on! Move it! Yeah, right!
There's a lot of love in this room. Look at this.
And Eddie Murphy.
Bottom line, brothers and sisters, what I'm trying to tell you tonight is that evil is good.
Let me hear y'all say it.
Evil is good.
That's right.
If he fails here...
Oh. Quickest way to a woman's heart is through the church.
It's actually through the ribcage, but that's a bit messy.
Being undead...
You got the dropsies.
Won't be worth living.
I'm a cop. If you try anything funny, I'll shoot you.
Women.
Vampire in Brooklyn.
I would love to have you for dinner.
So 1995 was a fun year for pop culture. I'm just going to do a brief overview. Thanks to Vogue magazine, they put out a nice article about 1995. This was a year Bill Clinton was president. Hillary Clinton was the first lady. Kate Moss was dating Johnny Depp. Coolio's Gangsta's Paradise was the top song of the year. Braveheart won Best Picture. TLC's Waterfalls won the MTV Music Award for Video of the Year. The Macarena went viral. Match.com came out. Drew Barrymore flashed David Letterman on The Letterman Show. Toy Story, Batman Forever, and Apollo 13 ruled the box office. Amazon sold its first book. Toy Story was the first computer animated film. Windows 95 dropped in every household. eBay debuted on the internet, and Pogs were all the rage. So there's 1995 in a nutshell for you.
Yeah, I remember that the theme song when they rolled out Windows 95, all the commercials was the Rolling Stones Start Me Up, because there's the start button. I don't know, did anyone not listen to that song? Because, you know, it says Start Me Up, you know, but the next line in that song is, you make a grown man cry. You know? Given how much Windows 95 crashed, like... I found that hilarious at the time.
Hilarious.
Well, my dad loved the Rolling Stones, so I grew up hearing that song. And then when I heard it on that, I know my dad thought it was like the coolest thing ever.
So I'm going to keep this short because I didn't get as much research as I wanted to done into the actual production. I spent the entire time I had allotted into this trying to determine if the film, in fact, was Vampires Coming to America. I really wanted to find out if this was the intention from the beginning, because the parallels are inescapable, and yet it seems there is no evidence that this was intentional or even noticed by most critics. People who, like, if you Google Vampire in Brooklyn Coming to America, the only thing you'll come up with is a comment about, you know, Eddie Murphy playing multiple roles in both films. So I don't know, is it just me? Am I the only person?
No, you are not. Not only that, it has some of the same cast. Some of the other smaller parts have some of the same people in it. So, yeah, I don't think it's an accident.
Anyway, so I didn't find out much more other than it seems like that was not the original intention of the film. It was just that Wes Craven was at a point in his career where he was interested in trying comedy and horror, and Eddie Murphy was a point in his career where he'd been doing comedy for a long time and was intrigued by playing a villain, playing a straight character within a comedy, being in a horror film since childhood. He'd been a fan of horror films, and movies like Jaws had had a big impact on him and his love of cinema. So it seemed like they were both coming at this project from different directions, and then their careers kind of went back to doing what they were doing before. Eddie Murphy went into more family comedy with things like The Nutty Professor and the Shrek films. And Wes Craven went on to do the Scream franchise. So they went back to their wheelhouses. But for this brief moment in time, the two joined forces for a film that tries to balance the comedy and horror. The only other thing that I found that was kind of interesting is there's not a lot of scholarly interest in this film, really just like one scholar named Leslie Tannenbaum, who went, as far as I can tell, way off the deep end describing how the film is in response to the Rodney King beatings and also to the AIDS crisis. We'll talk a little bit about Julius's character later on, but that he's representing the AIDS epidemic within the Black community and Rita's struggle within the department working under a white captain, that that's bringing up some of the police issues. Personally, I don't see this in the film, but I guess you can look at it from a deeper level. The production took 55 days. It was mostly filmed in LA. There was an unfortunate death on the set from a stunt person who fell doing a 42-foot backwards fall. The last name is Davis. She didn't die immediately. An unfortunate fatality. Not the only one on a Wes Craven film, by the way. The film grossed $19.8 million in the U.S. and $35 million worldwide against a $14 million budget. So, by all accounts, a failure and less successful than Love at First Bite. So, that's the headline here.
Normally, I save my reaction to the end, but there's a reason I picked this. And because I have the exact opposite reaction to this than I do to Love at First Bite, where Love at First Bite is still fairly well-ranked and well-received, and I don't think is that good a movie. This, on the other hand, I think was unfairly treated and is much better than it deserves. I think its tomatometer is, like, through the floor. It's like
11.
Yeah, something like that. And its rankings everywhere. And I don't get it, because actually, I think this is actually one of Eddie Murphy's better movies. Not his best. By any means, definitely not Wes Craven's best. But I think for me,
I would phrase it differently. I think it's one of Eddie Murphy's better performances, okay, but not one of his better movies.
Okay, I'll buy that.
Yeah, I agree with that one.
Certainly the best film he had made at this point in time for a long time. Now, the reason I chose it also is because I swear to God, this is an adaptation of Dracula. Now, I know that Charlie Murphy, Eddie Murphy's brother, and
Charlie Murphy.
What's that?
Sorry, I can't hear Charlie Murphy without thinking of Dave Chappelle as Rick James saying Charlie Murphy. Where he's like, Charlie Murphy.
Charlie Murphy.
<his brother>.
Charlie co-wrote this with Eddie, and I'm pretty sure they're not that detailed of writers. I think they sort of cribbed their notes from Dracula, because this begins with a ship crashing into port. The crew is dead. A wolf jumps off. It's, of course, this vampire who has come looking for a particular woman, Rita. We'll get into that in a minute, but when the ship, not the Demeter in this case, comes crashing into the docks in Brooklyn, there's an old guy named Silas who works there, and he's drinking from a bottle. The label says Wabash Deluxe, which isn't a real thing. Not to stereotype, but in the hood, this would be one of two things. It would either be a 40-ouncer at this time, and it's not big enough for that. It looks about half that size, or 20 ounces of fortified wine. So it's time for...
I never drink twice.
For this, I chose MD 2020.
Hell yeah.
In a brown paper bag. I went to the New Hampshire liquor outlet and got some, and it came in a plastic bag. So I got home and I took it out of the plastic bag and I put it into a brown paper bag to drink from.
Nice.
I chose the flavor Banana Red. Because, one, red, and two, this is supposedly a Caribbean vampire. So I was like, Banana Red, perfect. But I got curious as to why it's called MD. It was known around our hood as Mad Dog. Yeah, Mad Dog 2020.
Mad Dog 2020.
But that's not what the MD actually stands for. The MD stands for Mogan David, and it's called 2020 because it was originally supposed to be 20 ounces of 20% alcohol. So that's the 2020. It's actually not quite, it's actually a little more, I think, than 20 ounces, and it's not exactly 20% alcohol. But anyway, so who is Mogan David? If you go to their website, you can search through all of their products. They are a vintner, and you won't see MD 2020 listed anywhere at all on their site. It's actually kind of a secret, and if you know the history of the vintner, you might be able to guess why. Mogan David is a company based out of Westfield, New York, and it's the Yiddish pronunciation of the Hebrew Magen David, which translates to Shield of David, which refers to the Star of David. It was founded a few months before the repeal of Prohibition. So Prohibition's in effect, but how do they get around that? They were making sacramental wines, generally for Seder. And they just grew and grew. By the end of World War II, they were making 75,000 gallons in 1946. Max Cohen, the company president and founder, noted that 98% of Mogan David's customers were not Jewish. So there were other people who couldn't get it, you know, because of Prohibition, who were buying sacramental wine. And that's how they made their empire, essentially. But Max Cohen announced his resignation on the 8th of January, 1962, citing friction with his brother-in-law, Henry Marcus, who was president of the company. And he sold all his stock, saying, quote, "I am no longer connected with it, and I have no interest in it." Why would he do that? Well, shortly after that, controlling interest was sold to Richard Schofield of Westfield, New York, and he took over as president of the company and appointed Marcus chairman. And in the next year, they were producing dozens of different wines, two kinds of champagne, and they broke from their traditional Mogan David line with the introduction of MD 2020, flavored fortified wines, mainly in the Black community. So if you think about it, a wine company that was created for sacramental wines for its Jewish population, mainly sold to African-American populations, if this fact was known, might not be popular with either demographic. So I think that's why they kept it on the down low. Anyway, it was eventually bought by Coca-Cola Bottling Company. And when the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of New York merged with Coca-Cola, and you know, the main company, they already had an alcohol division, so they sold this off. I, of course, drank it when it was known as Mad Dog 2020 in the hood. And in Cincinnati, that had a double meaning, because the juvenile detention center in Cincinnati is also known as 2020. And you often ended up there when you finished a bottle of 2020 in public.
Yeah.
So there you go. My choice for this film, Mad Dog 2020 banana red flavor. And drink it from a brown paper bag. Let's jump into this. Like I said, it's pretty much an adaptation of Dracula with Rita as Mina and a police station that looks like the police station from Shaft's Big Score. I don't know if it's the same one, but it looks like it. John Witherspoon is hilarious. He's the only one that isn't cribbed directly from Dracula. Julius becomes the Renfield type character here. Rita, this policewoman's roommate, Nikki, becomes the Lucy of this. She's kind of loose.
Kind of reminds me of from the Beastie Boys song, "You Think Your Name's Lucy, But They All Call,
Her Loose."
I think I thought I'd seen her on 8 to 40 News.
And then there's one other casting that I'll mention. Joanna Cassidy is the police chief known as Dewey. This is interesting because Wes Craven's next film to follow this will be Scream. And the sheriff, played by David Arquette, is also named Dewey. The only other thing I want to mention real quick is the music. There was some pretty good music in this, Salt and Peppa with En Vogue and a couple other good tracks here.
I like this film a lot.
I agree. This is one of the stronger Dracula adaptations. I mean, even considering the ones that were trying to faithfully adapt the novel, I feel like this in its themes and depictions of the characters got a lot more right than some of them did. For instance, I love this incarnation of Mina as a rookie police. Like, it really gets at her sense of being an independent woman who has a relationship slash partnership with someone who's just like straight white hat good guy, but also has this internal struggle going on and possibly her own destiny. And so I really liked this interpretation of Mina. I liked this interpretation of Mina and Jonathan Harker's relationship, making them will they, won't they police partners, actually I thought was really great. And I liked the Caribbean infusion into the mythology, which I felt played well with the sense of it being spooky and not creaky. It felt like the characters all believe in this to the degree that they're supposed to.
I liked that he cast Kadeem Hardison as Julius. He was a great addition to the show. And I love John Witherspoon. He's funny in everything he does. He's just been in everything, I feel like.
Barbershop is what I always think of when I think of him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He plays the crotchety old man. He plays that role really well.
Yeah, he really does, man. He nails it every time.
I love the opening. First of all, like another movie that nails it with starting with the Wreck of the Demeter. Everyone has figured out this is where the narrative needs to begin if you're not doing it as an epistolary novel. But I love his discovery and coming on board and, you know, ahoy, motherfucker.
Yeah. Just
great line.
Ahoy.
He really steals the show from Eddie Murphy in some ways. It's just like the dog. They're like, shit, that's a chihuahua compared to it. Or like,
yeah.
Julius, you got the dropsy. You better check your dick.
Yeah, excellent.
Now, spoiler alert, the vampire's really, really trying to get to Rita any way he can. So what does he do? He slips into their apartment behind closed doors in Nikki's room, gives her the ride of her life without going into too much detail. I think y'all know what I mean. Okay. And kills her. And I don't know if you guys caught that, but I thought it was hilarious. The song, If That's Your Boyfriend, He Wasn't Last Night. That's the song they play after that scene. So I'm not going to butcher her name, but her first name is Michelle. And you can look it up in the song credits.
Eddie Murphy's really sexy.
Oh my God.
He does sexy, brooding vampire extremely well, even though he supposedly didn't like the wig very much. And he blames the wig possibly for the box office flop of the film. I think that's going a little far, but
it was kind of a mullet.
but he was very suave and debonair and, you know, gives Frank Langella and any of the other sexy vampires a run for their money.
Yeah.
That leads me to my first quiz question for you guys. Love at First Bite versus Vampire in Brooklyn. Better club scene, the disco in Love at First Bite or Dr. Zico's in Vampire in Brooklyn?
I'm going to go with Dr. Zico's. It was a cool club. I want to go there in person. Myself, yeah. If it were real.
Yeah, I would have to agree with Dr. Zico's club because, like, one of the goals was for the vampire to get Rita to dance with him. And so that was in the club. So not only was it a cool club, but there was a nice sense of anticipation there.
I think Dr. Zico's is the cooler club. But when it comes to the actual dancing, assuming you could hear it with the original I Love the Nightlife, the dancing scene between Susan St. James and George Hamilton, their dancing was better to
yes.
I Love the Nightlife than Eddie Murphy and Angela Bassett dancing to No Woman, No Cry by UB40. That was a somewhat suspect choice for a dancing scene. But other than that,
yeah.
Okay, who had a better car? The hearse in Love at First Bite or the limo in Vampire in Brooklyn?
I like the hearse, actually. I like his line about it of, you know, it's a car and a mobile home was like cute. I'm going to go with the hearse.
I'm going to go with the limo. I like the scene in the end when they're really stoked that they get to keep the limo when all is said and done. And that's also the scene where Julius turns into a, you know, a hot, sexy vampire himself. So,
okay. Better preacher, Sherman Hemsley as Reverend Mike or Eddie Murphy as Preacher Polly?
Can I say neither? I didn't like either of them.
Or one of them was like, bam, you turned yourself into Al Sharpton.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, that was a good line. That was a good line.
They were both good, but I'm always going to lean towards George Jefferson.
Better Dampier, or destined to be a vampire, Susan St. James as Cindy Sondheim or Angela Bassett as Rita?
Definitely Angela Bassett.
Oh, yeah. Angela Bassett's a total queen. I'm always going to root for her.
Better sidekick, Artie Johnson as Renfield or Kadeem Hardison as Julius the Ghoul?
I'm going to go with Artie Johnson. I felt like he was obsequious and helpless and dumb and all the things you want Renfield to be.
I'm going with Julius, so you're the tiebreaker here.
Oh, man. I like them both so much, but I'm going to lean towards Julius because I feel like his character was a little bit funnier. He had a lot more sight gags and stuff that he used, like the mannequin hand that had me rolling. So I'm going to just go with that. I'm going to go with Julius.
Okay, they both have a fight scene right at the very beginning when they arrive in New York. Thugs versus Dracula or Thugs versus Max? Better fight scene. With Mitch Pileggi, by the way, from X-Files, as one of the thugs.
I know.
Skinner.
I'm waiting for that one. I like the Skinner scene.
Yeah, I thought Max was more menacing. It was a pretty good fight scene. Also, just to note, the scholar I referenced earlier said something about the politics of the film, that Max takes on the police establishment and the mafia and is like thereby an uncontrollable black character who's taking down major white institutions or something like that.
It's Shaft. It's very Shaft. Yeah.
Yeah. Shaft as a vampire.
Damn right.
Better ending. She becomes a vampire or she becomes human?
She becomes human.
Yeah. I think it worked really well for Love at First Bite, and it's one of the only films where I'm like, oh, that's kind of sweet that they end up together. Like, they'll be happier as bats. But yeah, I think it's more moving for Rita to re-embrace her humanity.
I went with she becomes a vampire because it almost never happens. Okay, two last questions and then we're out of here. Most New York scene. What was the most New York scene in Love at First Bite? I'm going with the airport.
Yeah, that was pretty.
JFK hasn't changed since the 1970s.
You mean with the cab drivers trying to get him to take a ride and he ends up in the back of
everything,
the VW?
That, security, yeah. All that stuff, you know?
Yeah. No, I can see that.
Most New York scene in Vampire in Brooklyn?
I actually thought maybe the scene where Eddie Murphy is in whiteface as the gangster and they're in the Italian restaurant and it feels like ripped right out of The Godfather or something like
yeah.
that. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I like this character Guido.
Yeah, Guido is.
This movie took advantage of Eddie Murphy's ability to play characters to do the vampire transformation. I thought that was really cool. Last but not least, most dated scene from Love at First Bite?
Definitely the scene where he runs into the gang of black teenagers and smashes the window and one of them runs off with the television. Like that, or
yeah,
the scene with the Mexican family when the bat flies in and they're like, catch that black chicken. We're gonna, you know, you should leave us some eggs or something. Like both of those scenes were like, no,
yeah,
please,
yeah.
Cut.
I think I'm gonna go with the TV stealing. Yeah. This happened the year after the New York blackout, and there was tons and tons of looting, so I'm sure they were trying to make fun of that at the time, but it just, oh my God, does that come off as racist?
That didn't age very well.
Most dated scene in Vampire in Brooklyn.
This is maybe a weird choice. I'm going to go with Justice stepping on Julius's eyeball as like a comedy gag that you would not see in a movie right now. It's just a little too, like, gross and silly. It was kind of nostalgic to be like, oh, yeah, that's something you would see in a movie in the 90s and you would not see in a movie now. Not because it's offensive or anything. It's just like, I think we've moved past that in terms of what we find funny as adults.
I think, well, I just take a lot of the 90s fashion in the movie. I mean, some of it, like what Angela Bassett wore, definitely stands the test of time. You could rock that today. Nobody would look at you and be like, wow, that's so outdated. But definitely what Max was wearing and then what Julius was wearing when he became the vampire was very, I mean, that was 90s chic.
Yeah. For me, it's just the fact that so much could have been solved with cell phones.
Yeah.
Yes.
True.
That wraps us up for this time. We will be back with another Dracula adaptation next time. I want to encourage you to let somebody else know about the podcast. You can find us on every major podcasting platform. Until next time, this is Eric.
This is Rosie.
This is Johanna.
Signing off.
Snoop Doggy Dog, you need to get yourself a job.